which depends on the existence of the Clifford algebra, the gamma matrices form a Clifford algebra. We'll talk about that.
The fermions come
in sets that are acted on by Clifford algebras. Clifford algebras have dimension 2 to the n over 2.
Okay.
In, you know, n dimensions. So if you go to higher and higher dimensions, the number of degrees of freedom of a spinner is going up exponentially. However, the number of degrees of freedom in spin 0, spin 1, and spin 2 bosonic fields, which are the only ones we really know how to handle in detail, go up algebraically. Go up like anywhere or something.
Sure.
And so in large dimensions, you can't have a match between the number of bosons and the number of fermions, which is required for supersymmetry.
So do you look for degeneracy or something?
No, this is one of the things that restricts the number of
supersymmetry.
So you only have the supersymmetry. The condition for the matching of bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom can be expressed in terms of a condition on the Dirac matrices. After all, they're the thing that's responsible for their exponential increase in the degrees of freedom. That condition on the Dirac matrices can be written in terms of Octonian or division algebra.
That is the condition.
And the condition turns out in that language to be precisely the factoring that the norm of a product is the product of the norm.
Okay.
That is the property that makes a norm a norm.
With equality?
With equality, yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, a vector space is not a product.
It's a norm
on a number space.
Interesting.
So, Octonians, quaternions, these things are numbers, not vectors.
Right.
You know, they can also represent.
We think of them as vectors a lot.
Yeah, we do. We do. Because, you know, it's an eight dimensional number. It's a big, complicated thing. But,
right.
In the sense that they have this norm, they really are a number system. And that's why we have so much more power in working with them. But they underlie supersymmetry. They underlie the dimension in string theory, too. String theory exists in 26 dimensions or whatever string in 10 dimensions. I mean, these dimensions where string theory works can be shown to be related to the Octonian.
Why not use
some reason for thinking about norm division algebra? So the thing that Corinne and Tevian and I have been working on is putting together our different expertise. I've been trying to sort out the right unifying theory of gravity.
Right.
Figuring that's going to give us some insight into the right group. Once we get the gravity theory right, there are various gauge theories you can use to formulate general relativity. And there's, to me now, compelling evidence that the right one to use is the biconformal gauging of the conformal group.
Right.
Because in addition to giving you general relativity, it gives you symplectic structure and metric structure from the group. It also predicts the existence of time. So, you know, those are all nice results. It also seems to give, I think, and this is something that we're looking at right now, I think that the biconformal gauging is going to give the symmetry breaking that they impose by hand. They say, oh, let's look at the part of this that leaves L invariant, the imaginary unit L invariant.
Right.
That turns out to be, a certain electroweak theory of some sort.
That's what they were saying, yeah.
Right. A couple of ways you might interpret that, but it looks like it's related to the weak, weakly interacting particles in some sensible way. It gives you left hand.
Right.
And we know that the weak interaction is left-handed. The biconformal structure, by the time you project to a configuration space, also looks like it selects left-handed. So that just the construction that leads to space-time might give exactly the breaking they need to see the weak interaction emerge. And so, like mining the two things that we've been working on,
just with the 2x2 Hermitian matrices and looking how to write a gravity theory based on that, we're hoping we can get the weak breaking to work just right. Then we go to 3x3 Hermitians and, you know, get the whole shebang. Who knows?
Yeah, of course, we expect to have to look at something super symmetric. I don't know if they're 3x3 Hermitians. I don't know how those relate to super symmetry, but it can't be too far away.
Pretty cool.
So there's some exciting stuff to look at.
Yeah, no, I think their work provides a very nice complement. You know, I've been looking at the gravity, they've been looking at the gut, you know, together they're having a talk.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
So last time we did the classical Klein-Gordon equation, classical Klein-Gordon field theory. Next step, let's look at a complex scalar field. We looked at real scalar fields. Not much is different with the complex scalar field. It's complex, but other than that,
we do the octonionic scale.
There you go. You know, maybe we should. That could be fun.
Let's see.
Octonionic scalar field. So, a single octonionic field as a function of, let's see, where do we want to formulate it? Maybe Euclidean force space, so it can be an octonian.
No, thank you.
An octonian valued function of the quaternion. That's the wrong one.
Okay.
Turn it in Monday. Okay. So the action, I don't think we need to have here. We'll see why. We need to make this real. So we have phi conjugate and d mu phi. Is it plus or minus?
I think you have plus.
For Macchiori's metric convection.
I think it's plus, right? Yeah.
Plus?
I think, let me check this. I was looking at this stuff.
I've got it right here. Complex.
Minus. Okay.
Take this as the action. Now, does everybody believe this is the right action, or should we show that this is equivalent to two real scalar fields? Check that.
This is just phi on the right of what we had before.
Right. Let's write the complex scalar field as two real ones. Then phi star phi is going to be phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared, like for any complex number. And d mu phi star d mu phi is going to be, what do we have? D mu phi 1 plus I d mu phi 2 minus with d mu phi 1 plus I d mu phi 2. And I think there can be little doubt that the cross term will cancel there as well, so we'll end up with d mu phi 1, d mu phi 2, plus d mu, phi 1, phi 2, d mu phi 2. So the sum of this term and that term is just the sum of two real scalar fields. We actually wrote that down last time and showed that it had a symmetry and got the conserved inner product from the conserved charge of that symmetry. So, you're all staring. Did I do that too fast?
No, it's fine. I just don't have my glasses on, so I have to squint.
Oh, okay. Sit up here. You good, everybody? Done? Okay. All right, so, that's just an aside. What we do here is we vary fine as conjugate independently. And fortunately, these actions are simple enough that it's easy to check that gives you the same thing as if you vary phi 1 and phi 2 independently. Clearly, these are independent,
but it makes fine star independent. So if I vary S with respect to phi conjugate, you'll see now why I don't need the factor of a half. I get del phi star d mu phi minus m squared del phi star times phi. And I write that as d mu of del phi star d mu phi minus del phi star. So now the d mu hits the grad phi and you get the box phi. If I combine with this term, we have plus m squared phi. And this term, remember filling two boards with this last time, that's this step. It's zero. And so we just end up with the variation phi star times the Klein-Gordon expression for phi. So del phi star arbitrary requires box plus m squared, yes, phi, or Klein-Gordon equation for phi. So, also, if I vary S with respect to phi, I get the same thing. I'm going to have d mu phi star d mu del phi minus m squared phi star del phi. I integrate by parts and throw out the surface term, that's the two boards, minus integral box phi star plus m squared phi star del phi. And that's true for all del phi, if and only if box phi star plus m squared phi star equals zero. Well, this had better be the case because that's the conjugate of this equation. So when we vary field and field conjugate independently, the reality of the action guarantees that the two field equations we get will be complex conjugates of one another, which is fortunate because otherwise you'd be getting too many conditions. If the action isn't real, that will not be the case. You'll get different equations, so you'll be over-constraining the field. If you find that you vary some complex action and get your fields over-constrained, you've forgotten to make your action real. So go back and fix your action. Okay. Now, we can do all the same things with this that we did with the other. Let me see what he takes the time to explore. Nothing much, really. We can solve it like we did before. The solution is a little bit different, but only for one reason. Remember, we had a solution for phi before of integral P3P over 2 pi cubed root 2e. And then we had a P e to the I P dot x, four-dimensional product here. P mu x, let me write that the other way. And then, okay, here, for the real phi, we were required to have a conjugate of the amplitude for the second part. Now we're not. Now we can have a different coefficient, V of P, here. And we simply don't have to impose the reality condition. We have two independent fields here. We can take this and its complex conjugate, and those would be the... those are independent, or the real and imaginary parts of this, those are both now fields of interest. Remember that we had a symmetry that had a conserved charge equal to what we took to be the inner product of a phi 1 and a phi 2. Well, we have a symmetry here, but now we can see it's a U1 symmetry. Notice that phi going to e to the I alpha phi means phi star goes to e to the minus I alpha phi star. If we substitute those into this action, well, phi star phi, the e to the I alpha is going to cancel. Alpha constant means that it's going to cancel here too, so S prime is equal to S, and we have a one-dimensional Lie group that leaves the action invariant.
But it's global.
So, well, we can gauge that and we'll get electromagnetism, but we're not going to do that yet. We did that last what we're going to do now is find the conserved charge, find the conserved current, and satisfy ourselves with that. It'll be the same one we had last time, actually. It's related to that inner product, but if we were doing this for the Schrodinger equation, that conserved current would be a conserved probability current. All right, you do show this sort of thing in ordinary quantum mechanics, and it shows you that the probability, the total probability, will always be one because psi star psi is conserved. The integral of psi star psi over volume is constant in time. That's the conserved charge we get. We always take that charge to be one in quantum mechanics. Here is some inner product of the field. So let's just check that again. Let's see. If we do an arbitrary variation of the action, then we have d mu of whatever we do to find star, d mu phi. We also have d mu of phi star, d mu of whatever we do to phi. Then minus m squared will have a del phi star term times phi m squared phi star del phi. We have all of that. It's this general variation. And I'm going to integrate by parts, but now this doesn't go to zero because this is an arbitrary variation. So we get two surface terms. We're going to have d mu of d mu phi times del phi star, and we're going to have d mu of phi star times the variation of phi. Sorry, the divergence of that, that I need to put these in the same position. So I can lower this and raise that just using the symmetry of the metric. And then we have minus box phi star plus m squared phi star del phi, and we have box plus m squared phi times del phi star. Well, this will all be correct. Everybody listening?
Yep. The left two are zero. Yeah.
Okay, so now we make the simplification. We're going to let del phi star be symmetry variations. And we're going to let the field equation help.
this gives us, this gives us del S is identically zero. This one gives us box plus M squared phi is zero, and box plus M squared phi star is zero. So what we're left with is zero equals the divergence of let's take this index down. And now what are these variations? Well, we want an infinitesimal variation. So del phi is it's e to the I alpha phi minus phi is about equal to 1 plus I alpha phi minus phi is I alpha phi, and del phi star is similarly minus I alpha phi star. So those are the symmetry variations we'll consider. We have this current with the index up, so we're going to have an overall, here's a minus I alpha from this variation, and then we have a phi star and a d mu phi. Then from this one we have I alpha and a phi and a d mu phi star. And now you recognize the current we had before, j mu, is we drop the constant alpha and we have I phi d mu phi star minus phi star d mu phi. Same thing we had before, only we've done it with mu 1 instead of SO2. Any questions on all that? Joe, that looks like a question.
I guess I should admit that I'm lost.
Okay, where did you get lost?
Okay, so what is an arbitrary variation compared to what we normally do?
With everything in sight. Very good. All right, now,
in any way possible.
Actually, I did not vary the coordinates here. Right, Maggiore talked about he very carefully separates internal and external. He varies the coordinate and the field. What I'm talking about is an arbitrary variation of the field. Two boards ago, when we found the field equation, I did a variation of the field subject to the condition that the variation vanishes on the boundary. So when I do the surface term in that case, that boundary term vanishes because I've chosen del phi and del phi star to vanish on that boundary interval. But when I'm doing the Noether theorem, you do not restrict the variation to vanish on the boundary. That's the main difference here. Sometimes, depending on what the symmetry is, I could do a more general variation here. I could also have varied the coordinates. And remember, that changes the volume element over there. There's this determinant you get varying. So if I let the x's vary, so I'm doing like a translation or a Lorentz transformation of the coordinates. There is a more general variation I could have done. If I wanted to find the stress energy tensor, for example, by doing a coordinate translation, then the variation I would do would be an arbitrary coordinate variation. In that case, the variation of phi would be just the way phi changes when I change coordinates.
But instead, this time, you imposed some other symmetry conditions.
Most carefully, this variation is of coordinates and field. I didn't do that because I knew that the variation I was doing was only a variation of the fields here. So I only varied fields here, not coordinates.
It was internal, right?
But it's internal, yeah.
But the most general variation I could do is the very five star and X view. And that would give some more terms that I end up just throwing out, because the variation I'm doing at this step doesn't involve variation of coordinates. So we have seen a little bit more more general variation. The thing I'm after when I do Noether's theorem is this surface term. That's what contains the conserved current. And so as long as what variation I do up here is enough to get me this current, that's all the variation I need to do.
So that's the Noether current?
Yeah, this is the Noether current. I'll pull it out here. This is conserved. So d mu j mu here is zero. And if I take the time component of this, integrate over d3x, that charge is conserved. That's the electric charge. So I can really say q electric charge is the integral of j 0 d3x. And dq dt is 0. As long as no charge flows over the boundary. This gives us that d mu j mu. So these calculations are important, right? They arise from symmetries of the action, but in the end they give us conserved quantities. In physics, we're in the business of making predictions, and the best way to make a prediction is to find a conserved quantity. I predict that tomorrow you'll measure the same value of Q as we measure today. There's a prediction. Okay. So find as many conserved quantities as you can, and it lets you predict. Momentum is always a good bet.
Well, the action value, that translation invariant.
I think so, yeah.
How about the restriction you place on the variations of the waves? What inspired us to make those symmetry variations?
Emily Nussbaum.
Okay.
Right. This is the theorem. She says, do a general variation of an action. Restrict the variation to a symmetry variation so that del F is identically zero. At the same time, impose the field equations, and you have something left. You have this term left.
Got it.
That gives a conserved quantity. Okay. So, from a symmetry, she tells us we can always find a conserved quantity.
Okay.
This is the very simple implementation in sure. Field theory of that. You've seen that.
That's good.
The theorem beforehand.
So what is, like, I haven't really thought about this, what would be, like, the conserved current, you know, like the GR action, general relativity, yeah.
General coordinate invariant.
Oh, okay, okay.
Or local Lorentz.
Okay.
Depending on which formulation. So the way we do it, it's local Lorentz.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, and the conservation laws that we have the against.
Oh, okay.
Right, those are the conserved currents.
And if you have, like, dilatational symmetry and interactions, then what do you...
I'm not sure what you call the current you get. Let's see, what actions would we try it on? You need a scale invariant action.
Right, right,
you
right.
An R-squared thing or the biconformal action.
Right.
If you do it with the biconformal action, that'd be fun. Mm-hmm. Let's try that for the linear biconformal action.
Okay.
Yeah, apply Noether's theorem for scaling.
Right, so you should get some kind of conserved charge, you know.
Yeah. It's probably the Bianchi identity for the dilatation equation. Right, which is, what is it? What covariant exterior derivative of the dilatational curvature is zero, right? So it tells you that the dilatational curvature comes from the potential. I bet that's what they the check. I'm not sure. Okay, probably enough on the chart, quite enough on the complex scalar field. I almost call it a charged scalar field, because what we'll find when we do gauge theory is that the U1 symmetry leads to the introduction of a new vector field, which we identify with the photon. And
whose field strength is the max, gives the Maxwell field in the Maxwell field equation. And what happens when you do that gauge theory with a complex scalar field is that this electric charge couples to the photon. So there is an electromagnetic interaction between charged scalar fields. One of these, phi is positively and phi star negatively charged. They have opposite electric charges, which in quantum field theory means they can exchange photons, resulting in a net force between them. So, an equivalent name for this is a charged scalar field. Charge in quantum field theory enters as complex conjugation. So
let me ask that we're gonna leave them complex, and there's no forthcoming reality condition that we're gonna imply or apply or
that one's real. This is imaginary times I is real, so this current is real. That's what we measure.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, before we used this like an inner product, that was a real value of inner product. So, the measurable predictions are going to be real.
Cool.
Any other
they should do.
Yeah. Yeah. I get so tired of trying to imagine the measure of imaginary quantity. I can imagine measuring, but I can't really do it. Maggiore makes a big deal of how fundamental left and right-handed spinner fields are. I think he's wrong. It looks very much to me as if the reason for right and left-handed spinners playing an important role in the weak interaction is because of some symmetry breaking from some unified model. The weak interaction, the electroweak interaction arises as a U1 cross SU2 gauge theory. And the SU2 gauge theory brings in the extra fields that give us the W and V particles. those fields are left-handed spinners, the phi sub L that Maggiore has spent a lot of time talking about. However, the electroweak theory can easily arise from SU2 cross SU2, or SU2 cross SU2 is the covering group of SO4. So if you have any theory with an SO4 symmetry in it, you can immediately write what's called a left-right symmetric electroweak theory with two SU2s, SU2 left cross SU2 right. And now some symmetry break can break the SU2, the symmetry of the SU2 right. That could be dynamically broken, that could be broken by some compactification. There are various means for breaking symmetries in field theory. And if that SU2 right is now broken down to a U1, say, now you have something that looks like the electroweak theory, and you don't have to have formulated it in terms of Majorana spinners from the start, in terms of these, file spinners, these left and right-handed spinners from the start. Moreover, most unified theories start out in higher dimensions. And if you want to talk about spinner fields in higher dimensions, the place to start is the corresponding Clifford algebra. And I'll talk about Clifford algebras today. We'll get the gamma matrices and the Dirac equation. We'll do all of that. If we start out in 10 dimensions, let's say we start out in 10-dimensional Minkowski space like string theory does. okay, we've got the corresponding spinners are 2 to the n over 2 is 2 to the 5th, 32-dimensional complex vectors. Those are the simplest way to write S091 in terms of some 32-component spinners. Right? These are not file spinners. These are Dirac spinners. You know, they satisfy some Dirac equation. Okay, there's going to be a lot of symmetry breaking that's going to take a model like that and break that 32-component spinner into 4 8-component spinners that or 8 4-component spinners that are normal fields. So you've got, you know, really 8 spinner fields on space-time by the time you break that symmetry down. And it could easily break further to get a left-right asymmetric weak interaction. The general formulation of such things is, comes from group theory. Right? Group theory tells us that if we have any orthogonal symmetry or pseudo-orthogonal symmetry, the Lorentz group, what is the fundamental representation of the Lorentz group? Well, it's not in terms of left-handed spinners. It's in terms of Dirac spinners. Right? The covering group of the Lorentz group acts on Dirac spinners. You can formulate that in terms of 2-component spinners, but you'll want a pair. From a mathematical point of view, Maggiore is insistent on, building everything up from left-handed spinners, really misses the unifying view you get by understanding Clifford algebras and Dirac spinners. So I'm going to start with Dirac theory. And what you find when you do Dirac spinners is that there's always a projection operator that lets you produce left and right-handed pieces of them. If you are familiar with the gamma views, you know there's a gamma 5. And 1 plus or minus gamma 5 is a projection operator that will give you the left and right-handed pieces. Independently of the basis, he's forced by his construction here to restrict to a particular representation of the Dirac matrices, and later he mentions, you could transform these to lots of other ways, and it sounds very ad hoc the way he does it. You build it up, but we could have chosen this combination to be the Dirac spinner instead of that combination, and then we'd have a different representation for the gamma matrix. He loses all perspective on the importance of the gamma matrix. We're going to be working with them a lot, so let's just take Dirac theory from the top, and we'll project back to get the left and right spinners later. Were you ready?
I'm just checking. I think I have it all. Yeah, I do.
All right. Now, what do we all know about this? We've talked about this before. It probably won't hurt to tell it to you again.
Of course, there will.
What's that?
Of course, there will. Okay.
Yeah, I'll move that out of the way and shout towards the speaker.
This is for Jeff. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, actually, Jeff will appreciate having this one
thoroughly recorded.
Okay. So, Dirac spinners. At issue here is, what is a spinner? It's a fundamental representation of the Lorentz group. Okay, if we want to find all Lorentz transformations, we can write these 4x4 matrices that preserve the Minkowski line element, but they're actually, in some sense, twice as many transformations as that. The most fundamental object that
the Lorentz group acts on are complex vectors.
SL2C.
Well, you can do SL2C. SL2C is an accidental isomorphism. Okay, what we want is the covering group of SO31 That's true for any orthogonal group. If I write SOP2, its covering group is SpinP2. It happens, this is the symbol for isomorphism, that SpinP1 is isomorphic to SL2C. So we introduced SL2C and talked about the two-component spinners that acts on. We found two kinds of two-component spinners, the dotted and undotted ones. And ultimately, we put those together into some four-component thing, but SpinP1 gives you that four-component thing right off the bat. Now, let me ask you guys what development of this you want to see. I think I've been through this before with you. We can take the square root of the Klein-Gordon equation the way Dirac did originally, or we can, on the other end of the mathematical spectrum, we can show that for SOPQ, the associated Clifford algebra basis has commutators that generate the covering group of SOPQ. Probably don't want to go through all that today.
Well, I would like to see that one, though. I think
you want to see that one?
I like to see it, right?
Yeah. why don't I do an example of that one using the four-dimensional case? But this calculation I'm going to go through is, it works for any dimension, okay? Take any SOP2 where P plus Q is the dimension N. The steps I'm going to do here will apply equally well to that. So, SO31 is the group preserving an inner product. Adam, you knew. Let's go ahead and stick with, SO13.
Oh. No.
Sorry.
No, let's do it the other way.
We probably want to wind up consistent with Maggiore's notation, so I apologize for the mess that makes in your notes, but really 1-3 is the case we want to do. Define recall.
I have to take a test in another class.
Oh, well, good luck on the test. Check the notes.
Yeah.
The Lie algebra. Of SO... I'm going to write 3-1 every day. SO13 is... we can write it this way. MAB with MCD is... Kronecker CD MAD minus, B. And we have to anti-symmetrize on AB, so that's going to give us eta AC MBD. We have to anti-symmetrize CD, that's going to give us eta dd mac, and then we have to do both. So if I flip ab on this, I get a plus Kronecker ad mbc. Right, that's the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group. We've done that before, right? We've seen that. If you
compute the infinitesimal generators of Lorentz transformations. They're these anti-symmetric things. They're raising index, and they're these M's. You can write them with a bunch of Kronecker's and compute this commutator, and it turns out to be this. So what I want to do here is show you another way to get that same Lie algebra. So we'll be getting another representation of the same group when we exponentiate the Lie algebra. And the representation we get this way will always give a 2-to-1 covering of what you get by exponentiating these. So what we're really finding here will always give you the covering group, spin p cubed, of the group with this. And this is the Lie algebra for FOPQ. The only difference is every time you raise one of these indices, this thing's got p plus signs and q minus signs in it. That's the only difference between any two FOPQs. Okay. Define matrices gamma A by let's just stick with AD here. The anti-commutator of gamma A with gamma B is twice the metric. Okay, so in our case, for SO13, there are four. In general, there are n, p plus q is n. Okay, then let sigma AB be the commutator of 2 gamma. Then if I look at the commutator of 2 sigma, which is getting a little perverse, CD, but notice that if A equals B, let's see, this is gamma A, gamma B, minus gamma B, gamma A. Notice that A to AB is a diagonal matrix. There's an identity matrix over here. So these gammas are some matrices. Their anti-commutator gives the identity matrix if A equals B. Now, times some of the constants, if A equals B. If A is different from B, this side is zero, which means that for all A not equal to B, we have gamma A, gamma B equals minus gamma B, gamma A. So I can write this as just twice gamma A, gamma B, with the understanding that A is not equal to B. That will simplify this a lot. So I can write this as the commutator of twice gamma A, gamma B, with twice gamma C, gamma D, A not equal to B, and C not equal to D. So we'll just keep that in mind. Then, let me get rid of those factors of 2. I should have defined these with a half or something, but this is gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D, minus gamma C, gamma D, gamma A, gamma B. And now I'm going to rearrange this thing, and guess what? It's going to turn into this. So, what I want to do, the strategy, is to rearrange these so that the two terms cancel. The thing we pick up from the rearrangement is going to look like that. And then these two terms will drop out. So I always have gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D. And now here,
I want to write this as gamma C. First, I'm going to interchange gamma A and gamma D. So, in general, they anti-commute D. But if A equals D, then I get twice eta AD in addition to minus gamma A, gamma D. So, in general, I get this thing when I interchange those two. That this equals that is just this statement right here. Right, this is gamma A, gamma B plus gamma B, gamma A. So gamma A, gamma B is minus gamma B, gamma A plus that. When I write this, always assume an identity matrix here. Okay, so I just got to do this some large number of times. So, A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D. Now, in this first term, I want to interchange now gamma A and gamma C, so I'm going to have minus gamma A, gamma C, plus twice eta AC, times gamma D, times gamma B. And in the second term, I have minus twice eta AD with gamma C, gamma B.
Let's see.
Okay, so in this term, I've gotten gamma A all the way to the left. Now, this is my fourth order term right here, this times that. Now I want to start moving gamma B over. So I have gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D. Then here I have minus gamma A, gamma C, and I'm going to write the gamma BD, DB as minus gamma B, gamma D, plus twice eta BD. That's this first term. Then we have twice eta AC, let's see. I still want to flip those two, so I need this term again. Minus gamma B, gamma D, plus twice eta B, D. Never sure if I need that term or not, but there it is. I may want to flip those at some point, but...
That's a D, right?
This is
yeah,
D here.
Yeah, that's AOL.
That one?
Yeah.
Okay, still focusing on the fourth order term, gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D, minus, okay, plus, and then now I want to put B and C, so I have gamma A, and we have minus gamma B, gamma C, plus twice eta BC. Let's see, I'm doing BC, times gamma D. Okay, then we have minus gamma A, gamma C, times twice eta BD. We have minus eta AC, 2 eta AC, gamma B, gamma D. We seem to have picked up 4 eta AC, eta BD. And we have minus twice eta AD, gamma C, gamma C. Okay. Now, notice, here, the first term here, the highest order term, gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D, with a minus sign. So that term cancels that term.
So we've accomplished what we set out to do back up here. We got rid of the fourth order term by rearrangement. Now let's look at what's left.
I'm trying to see the second term there.
A, B, C, D. Is it the
No, coming from the line before though.
All right. So I'm looking at just. Did I lose the term? Let's see. This term is this. Is here. So
oh, okay.
This is only the fourth order piece. So plus gamma A, then interchange the BC, and gamma D trail.
Okay.
And then this eta term I put here.
Okay.
Okay. So let's see what we've got. 2 eta BC. Gamma A, gamma D. Minus 2 A to B D gamma A gamma C minus 2 A to A to D gamma B gamma D minus 2 A to A D gamma C gamma B. And then I interchanged one of these for eta to give me this term, eta bd. So now what I want to do is write these back in terms of the sigmas. But notice, in every case, here's an a with a d, a with d, b with d, d with d, and nothing. In every case, I don't know that they're not equal, right? They could be equal in every one of these cases. So I have to use, I need to write this as a commutator plus an anti-commutator. So now I'm going to use gamma A, gamma D is equal to a half gamma A, gamma D commutator plus a half anti-commutator, gamma A, gamma D. Right? Why is that true? Because that's a half of gamma A, gamma D, minus gamma D, gamma A, plus gamma A, gamma D, plus gamma D, gamma A. And so I'm just adding and subtracting the same thing, and then I've got 2 times a half. So then if I use the fundamental defining relationship of the gamma matrices, this is just a half times twice eta. So this becomes a half of my sigma AD plus a half of 2 eta, so just an eta AD. So each of these pairs I can write back in terms of sigma. On the sigma terms, I'm going to get rid of the 2. So I'll have eta bc sigma ad plus twice eta bc eta ad. First term. Second term, I get eta bd sigma ac and minus twice eta bd eta AC. I'm just using this over and over. Then here, minus eta AC sigma BD, then minus eta AC eta BD. There's a 2 on that. Then finally here, I have minus eta AD sigma CB minus twice eta AD eta CB. And then I have 4 eta AC eta BD. Now let's look at the eta eta terms. They're minus 2 BD AC, there's an AC BD, and here are plus 4, so those all cancel. And then these two can. So what I'm left with is, and let me make it as parallel as I can to what we've got over there. We have eta bc sigma ad. And then let's see, if I interchange If I interchange CD, there's minus eta BD sigma AC. If I interchange AB, I get this term, eta AC sigma BD. And finally, if in this last one I interchange CD, I'm going to make this a plus eta AD, because sigma is anti-symmetric, I can write this as a sigma BC. And that's up to the overall normalization, that's exactly what I've got here. If I put a minus 1/8 here, I think is what it takes to turn that into exactly the same thing. This is the same factor we've seen before. Okay, so the sigmas are generators of the Lorentz group, right? They satisfy the Lie algebra of SO13 in this case, or SOPQ in general. If you let the range of indices run from 1 to n, it's the same calculation. And I think this is the point Maggiore is missing when he doesn't, when he stresses these very particular spinners, he's missing the fact that the spin groups emerge as the covering groups of the orthogonal groups, and they don't always split into left and right. You know, in higher dimensions, you don't always have those projections. These are the more fundamental objects. I expect that the left-handed spinners arise by some sort of symmetry breaking.
So Dirac got lucky, at least, at the square root of the Lagrangian equation.
Oh, yeah. He certainly did. It was a brilliant thing, the way he was able to push through and find, what it took to take the square root of the differential equation. Right? He really, really pushed. He made it happen. He said, I want some first-order differential equation that's relativistic and equivalent to the Klein-Gordon. Now, how do I do it? He had to have matrix components. The coefficients had to be matrices. It didn't work to make up numbers or vectors or anything, so he made them matrices because that's what it took.
And what are you called with
that word?
The groups emerge from covering as the covering groups for the special or just the orthogonal?
Either. Yeah. Usually you work with the special. So let's say SOPQ. They also would give a cover. Let's see. Now what happens with parity? I suppose to answer carefully, I should think about how to implement a parity transformation using the gamma matrices. It's an extra discrete transformation that's the difference between SOPQ and OPQ, right? So you have spatial inversions as well. That's really the difference. So you have two connected pieces of O13 that look, each piece looks just like SO13. And to go from one of those to the others, you do a spatial inversion. Spatial inversion is accomplished with gamma 5. Gamma 5 is the product of I, gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. So you can build it from these guys. So you have that transformation. So if you can throw that in, you'll get, in addition to these transformations, if you throw in transformations by gamma 5, you'll get parity. So you can construct it.
Did we do that?
Did we look at parity? I don't think we've looked at parity, really. No. But there's this one more transformation, and it doesn't add to the dimension of the Lie group, it's a discrete transformation.
So does another theorem not work with distinct or discrete transformations?
No. You need continuous transformations. Let's see. You want to do a variation, right? So, you can, if you have a discrete transformation, and that transformation commutes with, say, your field equation, then it lets you classify your solutions by their eigenvalues under that discrete transformation. So even an odd parity solution to the Schrodinger equation, say. That works because the parity operator commutes with a Hamiltonian. If it does, you know, if you have a plane potential, it does. So it just depends on the rest of your system.
I'm having a hard time getting the punchline. This is supposed to be the same as a okay. But is this, are we getting to the right-handed and left-handed spinner?
No.
Okay.
No.
You
asked about O3 versus SO3. Let's just take the SO3 for now. So back to the punchline here. This commutation relationship of these segments up to an overall factor, an overall normalization, is the same as this Lie algebra for the Lorentz generators. What that means is that if I exponentiate these sigma ABs with arbitrary real parameters, that's a representation of the Lorentz group. Okay? So, we've developed here a different representation of the Lorentz group. And finding out what representation we've got, I mean, at this point it could turn out to be the same one we had, but in fact it's not. It turns out that all we need in order to construct this representation is the matrices satisfying this fundamental anti-commutation relation. The matrices gamma that satisfy this anti-commutation relation are the basis for a Clifford algebra. And what we find is that matrices that satisfy that relationship have to be of dimension, at least dimension 2 to the n over 2 by 2 to the n over 2. So I should probably start writing some of this down.
Okay.
I'll leave that stuff up and work over here.
Let me just put it on the board. So the anti-symmetrized gammas are the basis for the Clifford algebra. Is that what you said?
The gammas themselves are the basis. So what I'm allowed to do is take products of the gammas to build other things. I'll do that in just a minute. So. All right. Let's use that. The matrices build more matrices. If I take gamma A, gamma B, all right, we've already said we get two things. We get a half sigma AB, and we get eta AB. So what have we built? There's the identity matrix, there are the gamma A's, and now we have the sigma ABs given by their commutator. This happens in general, all right? This is the anti-symmetrization of the product. Well, anytime you have a symmetric part to the product of two gammas, you can reduce it to an eta, right, using this. So the symmetric part of any product of two gammas always is reducible back to an identity. So the only way we get new stuff is by anti-symmetric products. So let's take all of them. So I can take gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, and anti-symmetrize that. There's a simpler thing I can write, because that's equivalent to taking a Levi-Civita tensor and taking gamma B, gamma C, gamma D, and that turns out to be some simpler object. I'm going to come back to that. There's one more thing I can do. F on A, B, C, D, gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D. Probably want to take 1 over 4 factorial of this. And actually, it's handy to take an I here. This I'm going to call gamma 5. And it's equal to I, gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3.
So we're using all real and gamma mixed then?
No. Are we? No. Let's see. 3 anti-Hermitian and 1 Hermitian, I think, is probably what I want to do.
Okay.
You find that you can choose these things to be Hermitian or anti-Hermitian, and you might as well. That's a handy property to have. So if gamma 0 dagger is equal to gamma 0 and gamma I dagger equals minus gamma I for I equals 1, 2, 3, let that be the case. I won't prove that you can, but if you check... He gives a particular example of gamma matrices in the book. You know, check them. They'll satisfy this. Then, gamma 5 dagger is minus I, gamma 3 dagger, gamma 2 dagger, gamma 1 dagger, gamma 0 dagger. And that's going to be... plus I, gamma 3, gamma 2, gamma 1, gamma 0. And that's equal to I. If I move this past 3 different gamma matrices, I get a minus sign, gamma 2, gamma 1, gamma 0, gamma 3. If I move gamma 2 past 2, I get 2 minus signs, so I still have minus gamma 1, gamma 0, gamma 2, gamma 3. And now I interchange the last 2 and get I, gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3 equals gamma 5. Looks down. So gamma 5 is Hermitian. Gamma 5 squared equals the identity. There's an exercise. Just practice with gamma matrices to prove that. They all square to plus or minus 1, so it's not hard to move them around and show that. Okay, these are always the defining properties of gamma 5. It's Hermitian and squares to 1. Call this exercise 1, exercise 2, prove that gamma 5 anti-commutes with the other gamma matrices. Yeah, I'm suddenly realized that I should give you guys a bit of practice with this, because
in quantum field theory. You've got to manipulate a method gamma matrix. When we do QED, you know, it's all about gamma matrix. So we'll be seeing plenty of these. You might as well play with them a bit. Get used to them. Okay. So let's see. Now what? What happens if I anti-symmetrize a product of 5? Yeah, why?
Go back.
Yeah.
So there's only 4 of these.
Yeah, there are only 4.
Yeah.
Anti-symmetrize 5 things, and when you only have 4, and you're anti-symmetrizing something with itself. So you'll always get there. So these are always in build. Where's your question, Joe?
About the first line going to the second, is when we change the sign there, is it because we're changing...
It's this sign here.
Okay, so it's all the...
This sign
driving the Hermitian...
Yeah. Gamma zero is the same, but three of them change sign.
So, but what about the fourth on the... Oh, that one's... gamma five isn't changing on the left, and then...
Right, we're trying to figure out what this is.
Okay, so we've changed... We've changed 3 signs.
Yeah.
Okay, and
yeah.
Then the fourth one.
These 3 change, that one does.
Okay, and then, but I was seeing a couple lines down, we moved to gamma 2 over 2.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was one behind, and I was looking at the way that things were moving over.
Okay,
and
so
I was counting 3 and seeing the sign change.
Okay.
The same, that is.
All right. Yeah. So this move is 3. That takes us to here with a sign.
Right. Okay.
Sure.
Individually.
So how many of these things are there? Let's count. There's one identity. There are 4 gamma matrices. How many anti-symmetric, how many commutators are there?
6.
6, yeah. 6 generators for the Lorentz group, they're ready to be 6. There are 6 of these. All right, these aren't hard to count if we think of them that way. There are going to be 4 of these. 4 of those are independent because there's one free index here. And then gamma 5, there's only 1 gamma 5. So we have 1 plus 4 plus 6 plus 4 plus 1 is 16. So by taking products of these things, we've generated 16 matrices. These are all independent. It's, here's a fact. Let's see. The trace of the gammas is 0. In fact, the trace of any of these things. I'm jumping ahead too fast. Hang on. There was something else I wanted to show you. If I take real linear combinations, so let WAB be a real anti-symmetric matrix, I'm double counting. If I held A less than B, then I'd get one of each of these sigmas. But the exponential of arbitrary linear combinations of the sigmas is a Lorentz transformation. All right, that's because the sigmas satisfy the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group. So somehow, that thing is a Lorentz transformation. We just don't know yet what it acts on. What it acts on are spinners. It acts on some vector space. These are matrices. Matrices act on some vector space. It turns out that in this case, it's a 4-dimensional complex vector space. And the corresponding spinners are 4-dimensional complex objects. The fact that it's 4 is a coincidence because the square root of this number is 4. Okay, we can show that right, since we can construct 16 matrices which we can show to be independent, once we've shown them to be independent, you know you can't do that with fewer than four dimensions, 4x4. Right? In general, by taking anti-symmetric things in n dimensions, you'll find that there are 2 to the n independent matrices that you can construct this way. The minimum dimension in which you can have 2 to the n independent matrices is 2 to the n over 2. So the representation by matrices of a Clifford algebra, these gammas, in n dimensions are always, in fact, can be written as 2 to the n over 2 by 2 to the n over 2 dimensional matrices. They're complex in general, and therefore they act on some complex vector space of dimension 2 to the n over 2. So, let's see, I want to have you prove that these are independent, but I need to tell you how to do that. Then, given that they're independent, given that there are 2 to the n of them, then effectively you prove that they act on some 2 to the n over 2 dimensional complex vector space. Let's see.
Could we just say commutators of these children are independent?
Sorry?
Could we just say commutators of these children are independent if they're not zero? Or
commutators of what? These are independent of those.
Oh, okay. Right.
But in fact, okay, these, you know, let's see, I want to write these in a different way. Yeah, let me prove some things before I give you another problem. I was going to say, find four matrices that satisfy gamma A. Find them. Okay, there are lots of solutions. For any solution, GL4C here. So any 4x4 invertible complex matrices, then let gamma tilde A be M gamma, inverse. Satisfies gamma tilde A gamma tilde B is equal to M gamma A M inverse M gamma B M inverse plus M gamma B M inverse M gamma A M inverse equals, okay, that's just one, so I have M gamma A, gamma B, and inverse, and then here, that's one, so I have gamma B, gamma A.
Did you have to take out the M?
Pull out the M inverse. This is twice eta AB times the identity, and that is the identity.
Cool.
So, any similarity transformation of these things gives another set that works equally well. So there are lots of these guys. So I would just ask you to find one. You know, it's not hard to, you know, still the ones and zeros and I's.
Well, actually, it's on the website, actually, you know.
Oh, there are lots.
Because actually, you know, a week ago Wednesday, Corinne Tipping did this.
Oh, yeah, they've chosen some. Matt Gary has a set in there that we're find your own. You know, pretend you've never seen them before and find your own. I want you to practice working with these things, get a little bit of a feel for them. You need to be able to manipulate them, and the way to do that is to work with them. So, let's see, what else can we say? They're all traceless.
This preserves the trace too, actually.
What's that?
This preserves the trace.
Yeah, that preserves the trace. And that's the nice thing to know. Exercise. For your answer to number three, find the following. This combination is turns out to be you can write it as gamma 5 times gamma A. Alright, the point is, gamma 5 is a product of all four gamma matrices. And if I multiply by one more, I can anti-commute that one inside until it meets itself and squares to plus or minus 1, and then I have a product of 3 different ones. So gamma 5 times any gamma matrix is the same as a product of 3. Different ones. So having these is equivalent to having gamma 5 gamma A. So our independent set is going to be the identity gamma A sigma AB gamma 5 gamma A and gamma 5. So find those matrices. Find their traces. Or let's say show, because trace of 1 is, of course, 4, but trace gamma A is 0, trace sigma AB, all the others are traceless. Here's a little theorem. It assumes this result, okay? But let's see, does it? Oh no, actually, it assumes this one. Yeah, question. Okay. The trace of gamma A, gamma B, gamma C over any odd number of gammas is zero.
The trace of the product of an odd number of gamma matrices is always zero.
Proof? The trace of gamma A, gamma B through gamma C is equal to the trace of gamma 5 squared. Gamma 5 squared is 1, gamma A through gamma C.
Since gamma 5 squared to 1, that doesn't change anything.
Now, gamma 5 anti-commutes with all of these. So this is equal to the trace, say, 2m plus 1.
Now, I'm going to move it past all 2m plus 1 gamma. So I get gamma 5, gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma 5. And I'm going to pick up minus 1 to the 2m plus 1. And now, do you remember the cyclic property of the trace? The trace of ABC is the same as the trace of CAB.
All right, if you write it in components, it's obvious. You're just doing the same contractions no matter how you order them.
So this is the same as minus 1 to the 2m plus 1 times the trace. All right, so I can bring this last one around to the front. So I'm gonna bring that one all the way back over here. Gamma 5, gamma 5, gamma A through gamma C. And that squares to 1 again, so that's minus 1. Well, minus 1 to an odd power is just minus trace of gamma A, gamma B through gamma C. So this trace is equal to minus itself, and therefore is 0.
Just all these.
So I bring this to the other side, and get 2 of these equal 0.
For any odd number of gamma matrices, the trace of any odd product of gamma matrices is 0. So if you're doing 17th order perturbation theory in QED, you have to take the trace of 17 gamma matrices real quick.
Even
ones are a little more complicated.
So let's see what happens with even ones. You got this point?
Yes,
sir. Okay, now let me give you two more exercises. You didn't have plans for the weekend, did you? I know you don't necessarily all have time to do all of these, but the more of these you can do, the better. Let's look at the trace of 1 squared, well, that's still 4. The trace of, let's see, how do I want to do this? Gamma A times 1. That's the trace of gamma A, and that's 0. This is a general result. The trace of each of these things, except the identity, is going to give you 0. What's really handy is the trace of any product. So if I take gamma A times any gamma times any sigma, what is that? Enters immediate. Trace of the sum of the traces. What's the trace of gamma A, gamma B, gamma C?
Oh,
it's an odd number. It's a number, it's an odd product.
Right, sure.
Okay, let's see. If I take gamma 5, gamma A, sigma B, C, what's that?
Four, five, six, seven. Oh, okay. Oh, 4, I see where 4 comes from. Okay, 4, right.
Okay, let's see, what else do we have? If we take the trace of gamma 5 with gamma A. Oh, well.
4, 5.
Okay. Yeah, we already said that was 0. Let's see. All right, let's show that
What we really want is that the trace of the product of any two is zero, unless you're squaring one of them. So, let gamma A be any element of this set of independent things. I want you to do the proof that these are independent. So there are 16 matrices here. So A, big A is 1 up to 16. You don't need to know which one's which. Just this helps me state the problem. Show that there's a trace gamma A, gamma B equals 0 0 for all A not equal to B, and is lambda times if lambda not equal to 0 for all A equals B. So all of these square to something with a trace, and the trace of any other product is 0. And find lambda. If you want to, you can use your particular representation, right? You can use the particular ones you find here, but it doesn't depend on that. So try not to. The more you can prove without picking a particular representation, the only property that we ever use is the defining relationship for the anti-commutator.
Can you show them this has a trace of the gamma zero?
Yeah, I don't remember how. see if you can find this. I forget how that goes. One is an odd number of gammas.
Oh, okay.
There we go. So we get some of these for free. Okay, so that's trivial. That we just did because it's odd. That we did because it's odd. Yeah, these two are a little tricky.
Hey,
Karen.
Hi. Sorry to bother you.
No, you're not bothering. A welcome break. Okay, so proving that these matrices are independent, it's useful to have these relationships. Okay, because you can use that result, and you'll see how this goes. We've got this photograph, yeah. All right, so finally, let's see, this is up to 5. So, exercise 2. Prove that the gamma A are independent. Okay, so here's how the proof goes. I'll set it up and you can implement it and check. Let M be a linear combination of all of them. So some linear combination for any WA. Well, for any WA. For these to be independent, if we can show and that M equals 0 if and only if WA. Okay, so
So, so set, right, W A gamma A. What is this? This is like this is just some linear combination of all these guys, right? We have some B A gamma A. We have some, you know, W A B, sigma A B. We have some take another letter C A, gamma 5, gamma A, and a D times gamma 5. Okay, that's, so I'm letting W be what, A and B A and W A B and C A and D equal 0. Right. Prove that all those coefficients have to vanish. How? Multiply by any of the independent gammas and take the trig. The one, all right, so if I multiply this by gamma of B, right, here I've got a gamma A times gamma B, so somewhere in there there's a gamma A squared, and the trace of that one is not zero. So the trace of all these others is zero, so I get B A equals zero. Multiply by one, take the trace. Trace of all those is zero, trace of this one is 4A. Equals zero. So you very quickly establish, once you've got these trace relations, you very quickly prove by multiplying by each of the independent things and taking a trace that the coefficients have to vanish. Right, this proves that there are 16 independent things you can construct from the gamma matrices.
Worry about this.
And this proves that they have to be at least 4 by 4. And since you can find a 4 by 4 representation for them, 4 by 4 works. There are known 2 to the n over 2 by 2 to the n over 2 representations for the n-dimensional generalization of this. So that number always works. And it's the minimum. Okay, well, that's plenty to think about, probably. didn't quite get to the Dirac equation today. Okay, but, you know, here's the point. You know, these things, if you look in detail at the Lorentz transformations you get from this, it's a 2-to-1 cover of the Lorentz group of SO13. So this is the bigger representation of the Lorentz group than the, you know, boosts and rotations we've been dealing with. It's just like SU2 and SO3. Right? SU2 is a 2-to-1 cover of SO3. Spin4 is a 2-to-1 cover of SO13. And earthly a spin13 is a 2-to-1 cover. So the objects that these matrices act on are more fundamental than 4 vectors. These objects are called spinners, and they're some of the most important fields in the world because we're all made up of them.
But a 4-dimensional, it's a 4x4, right? So after 4 components, spinners.
Yep,
so,
that's right.
So it's the same, at least in 4 dimensions, it's the same, you know, the same dimension for spinners as it is for the actual...
Absolute flip. It only happens in 2 and 4.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, 2 to the n over 2 is not equal to n.
Okay.
For any n except 2 and 4.
Okay.
So, it's a coincidence of small numbers.
Okay.
Although that's the thing that's required for supersymmetry. So, if you want supersymmetry in higher than 4 dimensions, you've got to restrict your spinners somewhat. You can take Majorana spinners or Weyl spinners or Majorana Weyl spinners in higher dimensions. So, in 10 dimensions, they're looking at a special subclass of spinners to get supersymmetry. Okay. Questions?
Richard?
Yeah, but,
okay. Yeah, email me something if you want. Yeah, I still have to look and see if I have other stuff. Or, you know, that's one approach. You know, there are some other things you might try. And I'm not sure what's going to work in here.
Okay.
good Friday evening. That's a good thing.
Day of Venus.
Not with the what?
Day of Venus.
Day of Venus?
Yes.
The planet Venus. You didn't know. Why is it the Day of Venus? I didn't know that.
Latin. Dies Venus. Day of Venus. It's not in Spanish, it's a little better.
What's the name that in Spanish?
Viernes.
Viernes?
Viernes, but Latin is Dies Venus. So, forget the Venus in Latin, but Day of Venus.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Is it
V-E-N-E-T-E-S?
V-E-N-E-R-I-S.
I. Yeah, R-I-S. That Venus in Latin. Well, that means of Venus. I forget exactly. That means of Venus. I-S is that means of, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Like,
that's what that is. Like,
Venus,
something else.
Venus, yeah. 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 Yeah.
Any extra characters we can use in physics?
There is a character for Venus.
Yeah, look at it. Oh, Venus is cone, right? Look at it. It's like, it's got cones on it.
Yeah, like Saturn. It's like some funny character. Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Oh, well, is it that? Is that Venus? Mars, that one?
I don't know. We have the sun with the circle sun, right?
and then there's Happy Mr. Sun.
This is getting too rigorous.
Okay. Good.
I work with someone in my reputation, he's an undergrad teaching fellow, yeah. You know.
Uh-huh.
Let me, because it made it too, yeah.
But,